The hour is 10:15. We'll call this meeting of the Agricultural Rural Development Committee Policy Finance Committee to order. We don't have a quorum yet, so we will just get going and look at minutes when we have enough members here. Have a full agenda. Today is co-op day, of course, so we have a lot of our co-op friends here in the audience today. We have four bills on the agenda, and the first of which is House File 548. Is Representative Biskins here?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Representative. You want to move your bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, when we do have a quorum, I would ask that the chair move the bill to be before the committee. And then, Mr. Chairman, I would also then ask at your discretion, of course, that the bill be laid over at that time. And I'll explain why in my explanation.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm the proposal in front of you, House File 548, is a proposal that I believe does right by a certain constituent of mine, and he's here to testify. But what we're looking at is taking out some of the limiting language that we have right now for people who are raising waterfowl for sale. An agricultural endeavor, no one would argue, right, but one that under current law is not permitted, and in fact would turn his agricultural activity into and rezone his land commercial, which would of course put him out of business. So, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to introduce my testifier, Mr. Tashney, and have him give testimony.
Identify yourself and then proceed.
My name is Greg Tashney, and I started a waterfowl business quite a few years ago. I have an article in a paper. I'm trying to keep my farmstead for tax purposes. If it was to be taken away, I would be zoned commercial and be taxed to the point where I wouldn't be able to afford to keep doing my waterfowl business. My children have worked at my business, helped put themselves through college. It's brought me through a lot of hard times, and I'd really like not to lose it.
Okay. Representative?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. If you turn your attention to page 4 of the bill, you'll see that one of the listings of agricultural products is game birds and waterfowl, but only if you raise them to be shot at a shooting preserve. Right. Well, Mr. Tashney raises wild and exotic ducks and sells them to zoos, sells them to collectors, even sells them to state agencies. One of his vendors is the Department of Natural Resources, who purchases his ducks from him. I believe that language is too limiting, but I will say, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, just for full and complete disclosure, striking those words has created a little bit of a heartburn for our Assessors Association, and the reason I'm going to ask that this bill get laid over is because I'm working with the assessors on language which would be mutually agreeable. Mr. Tashney right now, just so you understand, has to carry permit a certificate from the Department of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. He has to have annually a permit from the Department of Natural Resources. Every 5 years, he has to be permitted by the feds for his activity. So what I'm working with the assessors on is putting in language in here which says that the person who is under this activity has to be carry the certificates and permits, so that a person can't put up a few wood duck houses in their backyard and now want to be zoned ag. All right, so it is. I'm working with the assessors to tighten it up, Mr. Chairman. When we get that amendment, I would then ask the chairman to bring the bill back up, put the amendment on, and then I would ask at that time we move the bill to the Committee on Taxes and especially property taxes.
And Representative, we have a quorum here now, so would Representative Anderson move the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I will move House File 548 to be looked at and then laid over for possible inclusion in the Ag Omnibus Bill.
And we also have a quorum here. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes of the meeting dated March 1st? Motion by Representative Kath. All those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Say aye.
Aye.
Those against? Minutes have been approved. Representative Biskins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you want testimony from the assessors. I know he's in the audience, and he'd be glad to speak to it. And otherwise, we're ready to stand for questions.
Very good, Representative. Quickly, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Biskins, well, I guess the chair is gone. But, I know folks that have chicken coops in the backyard, and I actually had somebody call me this morning who has got 5 duck eggs that they're putting in a incubator they're anticipating to hatch tomorrow. So how do you, if the bill is passed either as it is or with the certificates, how do you sort someone who's doing this as a primary agricultural activity or someone who's doing it as a hobby getting the agricultural property tax break?
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative. That is the concern, and that is why I'm working with the assessors on that issue. Somebody who's doing it as the hobby, of course, isn't going to be getting these permits because, of course, these permits cost money. And so if it is truly a business, you're getting the permits to do this. And then, Mr. Chairman, I could have the assessor actually speak to how they make that determination.
Okay, very good. Identify yourself for the record, please, and then go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Bill Efforts. I'm the Assistant Hennepin County Assessor, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a concern of opening up the agricultural class statewide, but we certainly understand the intent here. But we think that the way it currently is worded, that it is overly broad, and that's exactly our content. Our concern is, when does it become an agricultural product and when does it become a hobby for all of these agricultural uses? That is mainly our concern. Where does the line from residential to agricultural activity commence? But we think that we could work on tightening up this language so that it is not overly broad. We would be very much in favor of working with Representative to do that.
That would be the way to go. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, directly to Representative Hansen's question, as I look at the statute as it's currently written on page 3, line 27, start talking about what is agricultural products. If you look on line 32, it simply says poultry and poultry products. So, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, I don't know how the assessors determine if you've got a couple of chickens in your backyard, whether or not your property is zoned ag, and maybe the assessor wants to address that issue of how they do that right now, currently.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. That is a subjective task that is before assessors, that we need to determine when is it an intensive use where that use is so significant that it outweighs the residential value of living on the property. That it has to be intensive enough where We can separate it from more of a casual or hobby type of approach.
Mr. Efforts, would there be an income requirement attached to something you would come up with?
We certainly ask for that income that would help to make that determination, but we like to look at the operation in total to make sure that it would meet that test of intensive use. I mean, just one thing as it stands alone does not necessarily make it agricultural or residential. We have to look at all the circumstances associated with that property.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up, I'm thinking of a constituent of mine, I believe is retired, but has racing pigeons, which actually is a fairly lucrative endeavor as well. But so his income, he's retired from his old job, but receives revenue from racing pigeons. And so I think, Representative Biskins, when we're looking at poultry and game birds and waterfowl, you know, I've talked earlier about putting the pony in the backyard, but putting the pigeons in the backyard or putting the ducks in the backyard or the chickens, I think we could, if this isn't crafted well, open this up to a large potential misuse of this. So I hope that you can draft something that's tight.
Representative Biskins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Maybe we could look at creating a situation where people get huge property tax cuts, all right? But I'm kidding. That's not the intent of what I'm trying to do here, being very focused on this issue. And I think Mr. Efforts and I have a good working relationship. We do want to work together on this, and I hope that we put together an amendment that he and I come back to this committee and say, yep, this works for both of us, it works well, and Mr. Tashney can continue his business, because as it sits, you know, and I'm no blame here, the assessors are reading the law verbatim, as they should, and they're saying his 10-acre swamp has to be zoned commercial. Well, if you zone it commercial, he's out of business. Right? And nobody wants that to happen. So we're working together on this, and it will hopefully bring back an amendment where everyone is holding hands and singing around the campfire.
Any other testimony from the members of the audience? Representative Ward.
Well, did you want the audience first?
I didn't see anybody jumping up, so go ahead.
Mr. Efforts and Representative Biskins, let's just say that the current language stands. Do we know if there's what kind of a fiscal impact that is to property owners in the state of Minnesota? Obviously, as we allow, as Representative Hansen talked about, more use in for ag land, it impacts other local property tax owners. Do we have any idea? Are there any numbers? Was there a fiscal note done on this at all based on the current language? Do we have any figures at all, Representative Biskins or Mr. Efforts?
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward, no. I have no information on that. But also tried to do a little research to see if there were other people in the same business as Mr. Tashney somewhere in the state, and I couldn't find any. Maybe Mr. Tashney knows if there are other people in the state who do this activity. I don't know.
Any further testimony, Representative? Hearing none, Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 548 be laid over. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Nay. Motion prevails. The bill is temporarily laid over. Thanks,
Thank
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Next up, we have a presentation by a couple of members from Prairie Lakes Co-op in Starbuck, which happens to be my hometown. And also here today, as they set up, are the board members and management team at Prairie Lakes. Could you guys and gals stand up and could recognize you from Prairie Lakes Co-op? A good contingent. Hope you're all on vacation today. We had a brief discussion earlier in committee on agriculture moving ahead in terms of technology, and we have a good presentation coming up here today as this co-op is working on a joint venture with other businesses and companies in areas of fertilizer management. So go ahead with your presentation, And please identify yourself for the record, then you can begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Stahlberger, and I am sales manager for Prairie Lakes Co-op.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm Ben Brutlock. I'm a precision egg specialist with Prairie Lakes Co-op.
Continue your testimony.
Thank you. What we'd like to present for the committee today is a quick snapshot look at what we represent as far as Prairie Lakes Co-op, and not only that, in spirit of the co-op day here, the cooperation with our partners. We're going to go through a quick video. This video is a look at what our population is today, how quickly it's going to grow, and why we need to have a change in agriculture, why this change needs to be a partnership within the agriculture communities, whether it's from St. Paul, Minnesota, or back home to Mr. Chair's hometown of Starbucks. So we're going to start the video. Hopefully.
We hope.
And as it comes up, we're going to be talking about food for thought, what's happened in the last 50 years of population, how quickly the population has grown, where we were in the early 60s as far as what was fed by the peoples, what the peoples are going to be looking as we move forward, and more importantly, what we're representing here today as American farmer, how we can be a partner to that American farmer, how we need to help that American farmer be profitable and provide food and fuels and clothing and so on and so forth. So this gives you a quick snapshot. We're going to end this video. It does go on for about 2 minutes, but because of the time portion, what I want to do is bring it a little bit closer to home in what Prairie Lakes Co-op is doing, working with our home cooperative, which is CHS, bringing the producer, local elevator, travel to the export, unloading corn. So the snapshot thing is we are a global cooperative. So what does that mean when we drag it all the way back to Polk County, Stearns County, Minnesota? Is why is egg such a hot topic today? And because it's the response to the global population today at 7 million and in 2050 at the 10.5 billion.
Now, since we're looking at, and by that time in 2050,
go ahead, Mr. Brutlock.
We will have over 8 times our population in the United States, which is will be a big accomplishment to feed everyone and make everything move around the globe. Currently, by 2030, we need to grow 300 bushel corn, which is a long shot from where we are now. In 2009, we set new records in the United States of 165 bushels average acre to the acre on corn. And both for corn and soybeans, those are both new records. So just to say, how do we do this on the same amount of farmland, and how do we grow more with less? We have 134.8 bushels yet to go by 2030 to increase that average. That's over 7 bushels every year over the next 19 years. So how do we get there? There's 3 key messages for that. The main part is we need, of course, a lot of agricultural growth. We need research to make that growth happen, which leads to our innovation of how we make these things continue to raise and where we want to go. Commodity prices have increased, we have been able, farmers have been a lot more able to invest in better technologies with GPS guidance, variborate technology of fertilizers, placing everything where it needs to be, and keeping a conservation mind, sustainable agriculture. Us as cooperatives, growers, all of us, we all understand we need to be sustainable, but we still need to move forward and get up to that 300 bushel an acre we need. To do this, we have to have cooperative efforts. We're not going to do this one agency by themselves, whether it be us, Pope Soil and Water, or anyone else what we work with. So this is a real challenging deal. We got to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. Anything we do needs to be ergonomically sound, otherwise we won't reach that target. We have to work together on this. And the hardest part is keeping the growers' attention and making them learn and listen to what we have to show them. So how do we make this happen? We have areas out there. We have currently been starting, we started Rosselt Research Farm. In 2010, we cooperated and did high yield trials for different things with populations, fertilizers, fertility studies, water conservation, and sustainable farming practices.
So in 2010, Mr. Chairman, sorry.
Go ahead, Ms. Stahlberger.
In 2010, how did this turn out? We, at the farm, it was a 40-acre farm. We had our six companies that we work with, manufacturers on the bottom of the screen, you can see, and kicked six key speakers, of which we had 125 growers there. It was a huge success. Continuing on, so what will Rosholt offer this year? This year, the it's going to look a little bit different. As you can see in the red corner with the nitrogen study, this represents the Minnesota Department of Ag. We are partnering with them on a lysimeter nitrogen water management project. Within this study itself, we are working with Polk Soil and Water, Stearns County Soil and Water, University of Minnesota, University Extension Services, and ourselves, Prairie Lakes Co-op. On the bottom where you see the U of M micro study, this is a portion that's measuring phosphorus and sulfur, and what we know about sulfur and phosphorus as far as getting to that 300 bushel growth. The mosaic block is a piece, again, where we're going to simulate some of the same studies that we did last year so that we have more research data to prove, if you will, what had already happened. And on the cropland answer plot, those are demonstration type plots that show practical, sustainable practices within fungicides, herbicides, and varieties in which growers have an interest to come see. So that's, if you will, the advertising leg.
Mr. Chair. Whitlaw.
I'll give you a quick bit. You know, we talked about the cropland. With them being out there in this cooperative effort, we need to get farmers and growers out there to listen to us. Cropland does about the best job of anyone I've ever seen to get people to come and learn and be educated with different studies. Same with Mosaic. They're a fertilizer company, and they've done a great deal of work to help us get to that 300 bushel corn average. Along with, then we have to get to how do we get this information to growers, and how do we got to put it together to package it?
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
We'll finish with a couple of key points here. This is what we put together as a SMART goal, so it's a specific agriculture growth, being innovative of how we're going to capture the eye of the audience. Measurable, we need to get to 300 bushel corn. We need to do it with less environment impact. We need to be use best management practices. Attainable, it has to have key pieces of the puzzles that are easy to implement. These things can't be over costly for the grower, or it won't be used. It has to be realistic. Will growers take a hold, and is it economical? And lastly, it has to be timely. Can this be done in the world of ag? And the answer is it needs to be done in the world of ag. We need to be continuing to look for ways to feed the world.
Mr. Brutlog?
So what does this cooperative effort, you know, between all these organizations get us? It gets us very excited growers who are willing to learn and think about new ideas. It gives us a very long, lasting relationship and a tie between all these organizations that would have never come together before. And it gives everyone an equal opportunity to speak on behalf of what they want to teach for that time. And so in the end, it brings everything together to come back and make everything in that bigger picture.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Stahlberger.
Our commitment at Prairie Lakes Co-op, we're committed to the long-term success of our member owners. We create the relationships and coordinate resources that allow our customers to increase their yields, take advantage of our market opportunities to achieve greater profitability. Mr. Chair, this is what we would like to bring to the cooperative system.
Very good. Any further questions? Mr. Brutlog?
And just, you know, this is the conclusion. We need growth. To get growth, we have to research, which brings innovation. So,
thank you very much. Mr. Brutlog, could you just mention where this research plot is located?
This is in Westport Township, over between Starbuck and, or between Glenwood and Sauk Center, Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Any questions from members of the committee? If not, we thank you much for your testimony, and good luck with that research plot at the Rosholt station by Westport.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Moving along, our next bill on the agenda today is Representative Anderson, House File 539. Representative Anderson, welcome. Oh, I'm sorry. Could we hold on just a second, Representative? I apologize. We have Bill Omakin of the Cooperative Network. He wanted to greet us this morning and talk about Co-op Day here at the Capitol. My apologies, Representative. And welcome to Co-op Day at the Capitol, Mr. Omakin. Identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Bill Omakin. I'm President and CEO of Cooperative Network, which is the trade association for cooperative businesses here in the state of Minnesota and also in our sister state of Wisconsin. And I apologize to the representative and the witness for jumping a little bit ahead of them. Today is Co-op Day at the Capitol, and we have many co-op directors and CEOs that are here visiting all of you, or hopefully most of you today, sometime during your day. And we really appreciate the opportunity to come and appear before the committee. I had a slide presentation, but in the interest of time, I think I'll talk. Just by way of background, my background, I started as executive assistant in the Minnesota Department of Agriculture under former Commissioner Jim Nichols, then served as assistant commissioner of agriculture under former Commissioner Elton Radalin, and finished up as deputy commissioner of agriculture under Gene Hugesson. And I haven't been at the department for a number of years since I've been at Cooperative Network for the last 10 years, but a really familiar spot for me to be sitting in at the moment. Cooperative businesses function all across the state of Minnesota. We are the leading cooperative business state in the country. We have 3.4 million citizens of the state that have an ownership interest in a cooperative. And I suspect most of the members of this committee have an ownership interest in a co-op. And you've already heard from Prairie Lakes talking about agricultural production, marketing and supply, agricultural processing, Dairy Farmers of America, the process of cheese, Land O'Lakes, a lot of different examples. Financial, both farm credit and credit unions are cooperative businesses. Certainly, if you live in the suburban areas or the rural parts of our state, you're probably served by an electric cooperative. Insurance, Thrivent, is one of the largest co-ops in the state, as most of you know, headquartered downtown Minneapolis. Insurance, and that is in property casualty and health insurance. Health Partners, HMO, is a cooperative with 1.3 million members within the state of Minnesota. They also are considered a healthcare co-op. Cooperative housing, we have a number of particularly senior housing cooperatives both in the urban and rural parts of Minnesota. In fact, we have about 8 times as many senior housing co-ops in the state of Minnesota than anywhere else in the country. And our seniors who live in those housing co-ops, and by the waiting list is about 10 years for a number of them, so if you have an interest, you might want to start thinking about getting on that list. But the residents say they're part of a community, and it provides a much better quality of life for them than if they're just in some type of senior housing. And finally, grocery and consumer, and I know many of you are aware of that type. Just here in the Twin Cities, for those of you who represent metropolitan districts, 4 of the largest corporations in Minneapolis-St. Paul are cooperatives. I've already mentioned Health Partners. CHS, based in Invergrove Heights, is the 72nd largest corporation in the United States. They are a co-op, and their board of directors is made up of farmer owners from across the United States. So very, very unique type of business. Land O'Lakes in Arden Hills, same type of situation. And I've already mentioned Thrivent is a large co-op. We're unusual as businesses because we're owned by our members. We don't have stockholders. Our members who buy our products and services are the people who are eligible to run for the board of directors and set policy. So we're very, very unusual types of businesses. We have 7 cooperative principles. No other type of corporate entity that exists in this state or indeed in this country has a set of principles by which they try to live with. And some of them are, I'll just name a few, voluntary and open membership. So we're very welcoming to people who participate in our co-ops. Democratic member control, one member, one vote, very much of a Democratic with a small D type of system. Member economic participation, when we make profits, we distribute them back to the members. I'm on the board of United Farm Credit, which is based in Wilmer, Minnesota. We just did a $6 million patronage distribution back to our members, representing the money that we earned, much of the money we earned during this last year. CHS just did a $250 million patronage, and I'll make a special note about CHS. In 2008, when we were in the depths of the financial difficulties in this country, CHS did a patronage distribution of over $800 million to its farmer owners across the country, many of them who live here in Minnesota. And that was a huge cash infusion. And I can tell you, you didn't see other types of corporate businesses sending cash out to their member owners. And concern for community, we do more scholarships for high school and college students in the state than just about any group. Just moving along again very quickly, a couple of economic statistics that I think may have interest you. We have $6 billion in annual gross sales in the state of Minnesota, and our co-ops at our headquarters here do many billions of dollars of sales outside of Minnesota, but the sales within the state is over $6 billion. It represents about $18 billion of economic activity to our state. We have 80,000 jobs in the state of Minnesota directly within the cooperative system, so we're a big employer in the state of Minnesota as well. Just continuing on a little bit more, over 90% of the milk that's processed in the state is processed by cooperatives. Our farm supply co-ops do the vast majority of sales of fuel, feed, handle most of the grain that's moved in the state, and I think most of you who pay attention to international economics, grain exports are one of the few positive exports we have as a country right now to help our balance of trade. And so we think we're very, very important to the overall state economy. Just a couple of quick notes on what we're interested legislatively this year, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We've been very interested and worked with our partners, the Minnesota Milk Producers Association, over a number of years on the Livestock Investment Grant Program. Representative Erdahl and others have done a great job of getting that enacted into law, and we're strong supporters of that program because we think it's a strong positive signal by the state of Minnesota to our dairy producers that they should modernize and to keep Minnesota one of the leading dairy states in the nation. We are interested, if there's interest in the legislature, to move towards a livestock investment tax credit. Our sister to the west, to the east, Wisconsin, has a livestock investment tax credit, and almost every single producer now in that state has taken advantage of that. And one positive outcome is Wisconsin, for the last 3 years, their dairy industry has grown faster than the state of California, which I can tell you 10 years ago no one thought was possible, but Wisconsin is growing faster than California. So we hope that that might get positive consideration by the committee. We're also very interested in continued support for ag research at the University of Minnesota and the other campuses. Very, very important, whether it's a crop disease, new types of crops that could be planted by producers. And so we would just make that pitch to continue to look on that with possible favor, even though it's a very difficult financial environment. And then finally, we're working on a healthcare cooperative for farmers and agribusinesses. It's taken longer than I would have liked because the and rightly so in most cases, the Department of Commerce and the other regulators in the state want to make sure that there are adequate consumer protections. But we launched a farmers health cooperative in the state of Wisconsin about 5 years ago. Co-op has done very, very well. In fact, last year they did their first patronage distribution out to their members. We hope to offer the same thing here in Minnesota and hope to do it very quickly and hope to get a final approval from the Minnesota Department of Commerce in the next couple of weeks.
Mr. Olmekin, what's holding up the whole process of that health plan in the state?
What's holding up the process is that Minnesota law did not contemplate the creation of a member-owned healthcare cooperative. Basically, we didn't fit into the co-op healthcare law that existed, because that was really if you were putting up bricks and mortar, buildings and clinics and things like that. And we didn't really fit into the purchasing alliance co-op either, because we're forming an insurance company. So last year, we had to come to all of you and ask for approval of legislation that gave greater flexibility to the Minnesota Department of Commerce so that they could waive some of the requirements that they have, requirements that just didn't make sense. For example, we have to have a certain amount of reserves to launch. We actually received $2 million from Congress as that reserves. We got that in a grant, but we also had to get stop-loss insurance, and what the state law required is that we had to have a signed commitment for that stop-loss insurer by the stop-loss insurer before we knew we had state approval. Well, no stop-loss insurer is going to give a commitment for stop-loss to an entity that doesn't have a license yet from the state of Minnesota, so it's kind of the chicken and the egg problem. We hope we have that resolved, but again, it's taking a little longer than we'd like, but we hope to get there. I will just mention as an aside, and I don't want any of you to throw any papers you have against at me. Maybe this will defeat my credibility. I was appointed by the U.S. Comptroller General back in June to sit on the oversight board for federal health care reform. So I'm one of 15 members from around the country that sit on the nonpartisan oversight board. We're not attached to HHS or the administration. We just want, we're there to make sure that the money is spent appropriately. And there are $6 billion appropriated by Congress for the creation of healthcare cooperatives across the country. And I would very much like to see Minnesota take advantage of that, because wherever you are on the ideology of healthcare reform, this $6 billion is available to groups within the state to create health insurance companies. No strings, there's no state match required, no state financial contribution, and it would be a member-owned insurer, and it would do what we keep talking about as co-ops, create competition in markets where there isn't competition. And so with that, I would just make a plea to you, if there's ways we can help you, because our businesses in most of your districts, if there are ways we can be of assistance to you, please let us know. But what co-ops do is they try to provide for need that isn't being met for others. And a good example is broadband deployment in rural areas. In most areas that are served by telephone co-ops, we have been much quicker to get broadband deployed in those areas than the investor-owned utilities in the state. And because we're owned by our members, we have to be responsive to our members, and that's how we think for the state of Minnesota. It's a pretty, if I can put this really simply, it's a pretty good deal that we have a lot of cooperative businesses operating in the state, because the money that's raised from our members end up getting spent right back here in the state of Minnesota and continue to develop our economy. With that, thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope I didn't talk too quickly, but
thank you very much. Any questions from members? Representative Morrow?
No.
Oh, okay. Any questions from members? Okay. I echo your words. Cooperatives and agriculture are extremely important to our state and our nation. It's a shining star of our economy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we do have a reception at the Kelly Inn, well known to most of you, at 4:30, and you're certainly welcome to attend. Thanks,
Mr. Olmekin. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would echo your support, especially on the healthcare cooperatives and the need for broadband throughout the state, especially in our rural areas, so I'm grateful. Mr. Chair, I do have a question for you, though, as the, I think Representative Anderson maybe, is it your plan to lay over the remaining three bills as well? I know that a number of us have co-op members who are going to be pulling us out over the next hour or so. So I was just wondering what the plan is.
Yes, they'll all be laid over for possible inclusion, and in the case of Representative Biskin's bill, it will be called back again. Thank you. As we have a second, as Representative Anderson moves up with his bill, are there more cooperatives here? Could you please stand up and say hi to us and tell us where you're from? Any other co-ops from around the great state of Minnesota? We won't ask you to testify. Want to stand up? Hi. Thank you. Welcome. And a lot of snow up that way?
Yes.
Go ahead, sir.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kolpendreyer. I'm representing Eggstar Financial Services, headquartered out of Mankato, Minnesota, and we do agricultural, we are an agricultural credit association to farmers and rural workers.
Welcome.
Mark Nicely from United FCS. We're a farm credit institution based out of Wilmington.
And welcome to you. Any more cooperatives represented here today? Well, again, welcome to all of you. It's a good day to be here today, and again, thank you for your work with our state and in helping our state economy. Now we have Representative Anderson with House File 539. Would you care to move your own bill, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will. I'd like to move House File 539 and respectfully request that it be held over for possible inclusion in the Agriculture Omnibus Bill.
Proceed with your testimony, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many of you know this bill from last year, and it was held over, I think, in last year's bill in Chair Junkie's Ag Committee and dealt with. We are, again, presenting this back again because there are some concerns in the way that the bill was put into statute. And so what we're doing here is bringing it back, and the bill as it's before you would state that horse farms are an intensive agriculture use that may be accomplished under limited acreage. And without my going into further conversation with this, I brought a gentleman who's been actively involved with this testimony, Mr. Dayon, and I'd like to have him testify on his concern and his wishes for this bill to go forward.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, my name is David Dayon. I'm a spokesperson for the horse industry. I have a lifelong experience in horses. Dates from driving a team of workhorses on my grandfather's farm as a young child up to currently where I own a breeding and foaling operation in St. Michael, Minnesota, Wright County. I'm here today to give you a quick overview of the horse industry. Nationwide, the horse industry produces goods and services of $25.3 billion and has a total impact of $112.1 billion on the U.S. gross domestic product. The industry's contribution to the U.S. GDP is greater than the motion picture services, railroad transportation, furniture and fixture manufacturing, or tobacco products manufacturing industries. Minnesota is home to a diverse equine industry that propels both the rural and the urban community. Minnesota is home to diverse equine breeds and disciplines, a racing industry, college programs. Earlier, I believe last week it was, the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council testified before you, and the equine program is a very large part of their program. There are also various scales of operations, major equine industry leaders, and numerous equine organizations that are represented here in Minnesota. Unlike other species of livestock, in which the value lies in the quantity and size of the animal, the highest value of the horse lies in the quality of breeding and the ability to perform a certain task. The size of our industry could best be exemplified by the fact that the Minnesota Horse Expo is the largest single-species livestock show in the state of Minnesota. It represents over 58 different breeds, over 500 vendors, and is attended by over 60,000 people. The horse population in the state of Minnesota is estimated to be approximately 150,000 horses located on 13,000 farms. As there are multiple uses ranging from racing, exhibition, working cattle, rodeos, therapeutic riding, recreational riding, driving, breeding, and sales. The horse industry is an intensive agricultural use. An example of this is that the majority of horse owners average 14 horses on 30 acres of land. There are several related industries ranging from veterinarians, equine chiropractors, farriers. We are home to one of the largest farrier schools in the nation. Numerous educational programs and clinics, equine dentistry, truck and trailer sales, tack shops, English and Western clothing, bulk grain dealers, processed feed manufacturers, feed stores, hay growers and suppliers, straw, shavings processors, as well as horse stall manufacturers, gate and portable panel manufacturers, horse barn builders, fencing facilities and equipment insurance, equipment repair parts, and labor. As far as horse products, horses are the raw material for many products, including byproducts from slaughter, as well as material collected from live horses. The horse itself is a major product. The green monkey is a horse that sold for $16 million in 2006, the highest amount ever paid for any livestock individual species. One of the other major products derived from horses is the product Premarin, which is an estrogen product used for women. Attempts were made to manufacture this product synthetically and resulted in numerous side effects, and so they're once again going back to using the horse urine as the base product for this. Also, they derive platelet-rich plasma, which is used as a botulism antitoxin, a tetanus antitoxin, and a rabies antitoxin, as well as a source of wound infection healing in neonates. Also, fat-derived cells and bone marrow-derived cells. Purified horse serum is used for cell culture, black widow spider antivenom, snake bite antivenom, as well as an interleukin receptor antagonist protein, which is an anti-inflammatory. also anti-rejection drugs that are used in organ transplants for humans, as well as the horse hide, which is used for boots, motorcycle leathers, flight jackets, holsters and gun belts, baseballs and baseball gloves, and hockey gloves. And if I may break off for that for just a minute, in talking about baseball and baseball gloves, you probably all recently heard that Joe Mauer's knee was injected to treat him for some arthritis in his knee. The product that was used, Haluron, was derived through research done on racehorses over the years, and it's exactly the same product that is used in racehorses to treat the similar condition. Horsehair is also used for bowstrings for instruments and hair pieces. Gelatin is derived, oils for cosmetic and beauty products, and as well as horse meat for human and carnivorous animals. Although controversial, horse meat is a major product. It's consumed worldwide. The U.S. is forced to import it now with the shutdown of the slaughter plants. Minnesota imported 687.6 metric tons in 2008, which is the year following the shutdown of the slaughter plants. The economic impact of the horse industry, a recent trail-related activities study was done by the DNR and presented 1-12 of 2011, in which the trail industry alone has an economic impact of $600 million on the state. The overall horse industry economic impact study that was done by the University of Minnesota in 2004 showed a $1 billion, and 2010 estimates are that is now about $2.5 billion in economic impact. The legislative priorities that the industry is looking for is just during this session is to be recognized as livestock in Minnesota, to be treated legislatively the same as other species of livestock in Minnesota, to be included in the agricultural statistics by the Department of Agriculture, and also to do an updated economic impact study to understand the full impact of the equine industry. As relates to the agricultural statistics, I recently met with the folks from the Department of Agriculture, and they are in the process of involving the horse industry in the agricultural statistics. I would also bring your attention to a letter that was part of a work group that was done with the horse industry and the Department of Revenue. It's a letter that was submitted by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I would direct you to the final paragraph on this sheet, which says, "Finally, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture believes that a definition making it clear that horses are livestock is needed in statute. As proposed last year, Chapter 17 includes similar language referencing other important segments of agriculture. Having such a definition may not have tax consequences as discussed in this report, but it will help clarify assumptions often made about Minnesota's horse industry." With that, I would close and ask for any questions.
Any questions from members? Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for laying out all of the economic benefits of the horse industry. And I think I'm going to turn to Representative Anderson, if I might, Mr. Chair. The letter that we've just referenced from January 15th of last year, Representative Anderson, says having such a definition may not have tax consequences as discussed in this report, and we don't have the report, but I guess I would ask you, we were all working on Representative Lemura's Green Acres bill. Would enactment of the language you propose have any impact upon Green Acres or eligibility for Green Acres that we didn't address in Representative Lemura's bill?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, my testifier has something that he's received here from the Minnesota Department of Revenue regarding that, so I'd let him just read it for you.
This is a bulletin that was mailed to me by my city assessor laying out the situation as it relates to agricultural classification of properties. And in this document, it states that see The agricultural classification, for example, has specific requirements, while the Green Acres program has other specific and separate eligibility requirements. A property can correctly be classified as agricultural without being eligible for Green Acres.
And where was that from?
This is a bulletin to the county assessors from the Property Tax Division referencing classifying agricultural and rural vacant lands. And it's dated September 24th of 2009.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, I think I'm back to my question, though. Representative Lemure is carrying a bill that makes some changes, I think, on a bipartisan basis we agreed to on Green Acres, and I know that bill was just heard in another committee, I believe yesterday, but sometime this week. Would your bill have any impact upon the Green Acres changes that we're proposing now? I appreciate the letter. The letter is, although predates Representative Lemure's bill.
Correct. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrow, the intent was not to impact the Green Acres as such. This happens to be that I think Mr. Dayon is maybe an exception to the rule because he is on less than 10 acres, but he has very much from his tax statements and his economic showing that he has a lot of income that comes off of that. And so because he wouldn't make the 10-acre rule, he wouldn't be classified under Green Acres as such. So it's not the intent that to go and try and coordinate them together. It's basically because of his situation with the horse industry.
Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, Representative Anderson, and maybe you could reiterate, what then does passing this language achieve that we can't achieve with current law?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we thought we had it fixed up last year. We thought with the language, the way it was situated, going into a conference committee. At the last minute, the provision for referencing Chapter 273 got pulled out of the committee. And then when it came time for the assessor in Wright County to come out and look at his operation, he got assessed and was told by his city assessor, because he's within the city limits of St. Michael, that he, according to state law, is now assessed as a commercial operation. And yet, from what he was told, that the county was giving him a livestock or a designation as an intensive agriculture area, not as Green Acres, but as a livestock industry in the horse industry, and he should be considered that rather than a commercial situation. Mr. Dayon just talked with the assessor 3 or 4 days ago and found out that the assessor did change the classification back, and county assessors have that prerogative over a city assessor. So we're hoping that we can make this, put this in law to make sure that assessors don't do that again, and that it's now in statute.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for that explanation. Mr. Chair, I think my questions are actually going to be for you at this point. My first question is, will we have a chance, and I respect and I voted for that bill last year, Representative Anderson, so it's not, I don't have a problem with the language at the moment. My question, though, is will the county assessors be weighing in on this language?
Yeah, the assessors are here, and they're on the agenda to testify.
Then my other question, Mr. Chair, will be, you mentioned that this bill would be laid over for possible inclusion. I'm assuming you I'm not sure, actually, which bill it would be included in. If you're planning on having a finance bill and a separate omnibus policy bill, but since this bill certainly would have some property tax implications, it sounds like, would this bill then go to the Property Tax Division or to taxes to be heard? That's my question in terms of possible laying over and given deadlines. I want to understand how that's all going to interact.
Representative Morrow, I'm not totally sure on that. The chairman is not here today, but I would assume it's going to be laid over, and if it has policy or finance implications, it would be part of the finance portion of our ag bill. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Eakin might also have a follow-up on this. We're just trying to be very clear on the process, and I do respect, Mr. Chair, that you're not the full-time chair of this committee, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but rather to articulate questions that we on the minority side are trying to understand in terms of process. My thought would be that this bill would need to go to a taxes committee given that it certainly would appear to have potential tax implications. But Representative Eakin may know more about this than I.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Morrow, I too wanted to raise the same question in regard to the tax committee, because it does have tax implications. You're just talking about the commercial versus agriculture. So there is a tax implication here, and when we hear from the assessors, we'll maybe get more input on that matter. And I was also wondering about the, I wanted to ask also about the reference to Chapter 273, and if there was a problem with having that provision placed back in again, since I guess it sounds like there is no connection with the Green Acres, that provision then would maybe satisfy the concern some might have if they if they're concerned that it might have some implication there.
Comment, Representative Anderson, or Mr. Dayon?
I'll let Mr. Dayon respond.
Mr. Dayon,
Chairman,
go ahead.
Anderson, Representative Eakins, the problem is this is Chapter 17, Department of Agriculture. This is an agricultural definition. If property taxes are involved in this, then we feel that the property tax definition 273 should be the addressing statute. This is an agricultural definition. This is not a tax definition. If the assessors have a problem, then we feel it should be addressed under 273 of the property tax codes. This is an agricultural definition that qualifies horses for anything and everything. It's an overview definition of the entire industry. If property taxes, if revenue feels that there is a property tax situation, then we feel it should be addressed under the property tax codes.
Okay. Well, and Mr. Chair, it is an agricultural definition but may have tax implications. So for that reason, I do think that the consultation should be made with the tax committee. I think that the tax committee may want to weigh in on this matter.
We will take that under advisement. I believe there was conversation with the tax chair, and he indicated he was okay with keeping it here in the Agriculture Committee. But we will take your concerns under advisement.
Chairman Anderson and Representative Mr. Dayon,
go ahead.
If I could just point out one other thing. There are similar definitions already in statute referring to llamas, cervidae, and ratites that have practically the same identical language as this bill does. And none of those have any tax stipulations attached to them.
Any further concerns? Let's get the assessor up here and get his take on this. Again, the assistant assessor from Hennepin County, welcome back to the table, and identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bill Efforts. I'm the assistant Hennepin County assessor, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers.
So give us some help here.
Well, I guess that was our first question, is that if does this provision in this Chapter 17, does it have an effect on 273? Last year we asked that that provision be put into this bill that wouldn't have an effect on 273. As Mr. Dayon even commented here, that we feel that it's the way this bill would be, the tax ramification would be to qualifying anything and everything that's horse-related, and we feel that that's problematic. It gets to be really blurred as where is it commercial, where is it agricultural, and where is it residential. Some of our concerns in Hennepin County were, in counties where land is expensive and there is, you know, tax incentive to have your land classified as agricultural, there's some benefit there and some incentive for people to try to get that classification. So we need to keep it from our perspective, need to keep a line between residential, commercial, and agricultural properties. So up to this point, it's always been considered Class 2A land, that it's got at least 10 acres contiguous land that's used to produce an agricultural product. And so we've always considered the raising of horses, anything that had to do with the raising of horses, as long as you can legitimize that with some 10 acres at least at a minimum of agricultural products, assessors can go ahead and classify that as agricultural classification. One other distinction I would like to make is that there is a big difference between a class and Green Acres. There's a whole different litmus test of primary use to go from agricultural class to
green acres. I did, don't mean to ramble here, but I did talk to the county assessor in Wright, and Mr. Dayon is getting the agricultural class as intensive use. The Department of Revenue has given assessors guidelines as horses, as livestock, as long as they're, you know, it's related to the breeding and raising of horses. And based on last year's study, that, you know, the commercial boarding of horses can be done as long as they have 10 acres of contiguous land that's that is productive. What came out of that, I sat on that committee as well, and what came out of that is that we said that the pasture land that the commercial boarding operators use to graze horses could be considered land for production. So there are a lot of provisions in statute in 273 anyway where we can consider horses as an agricultural use. But it was clear, always more clear for us, that if we had at least 10 acres in production, then we can say, yes, that's agricultural. And now we get back to a lot of these uses where they're less than 10 acres and they're intensive. You know, on rare occasions, the Department of Revenue does, you know, recommends assessors consider those intensive use. And I do believe Mr. Dayon's property is considered agricultural class. I think there was probably some strife between the city assessor and the county assessor because of this situation where it's less than 10 acres. Where's the line between, you know, commercial activity, boarding, residence? So that's my understanding in this case. Just to kind of reiterate that we do consider horses to be livestock in certain situations, and we do provide currently for intensive use of agricultural use to get the agricultural class of less than 10 acres under unique situations. I hope I have addressed most of your concerns.
Thanks, Mr. Efforts. Any questions from members of the committee? Any further questions? Representative Egan.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, do you believe that this law, this change, would allow somebody, you know, with two or three horses on 7 acres, say in the suburbs, claim lower taxes, be classified as agricultural, and claim lower taxes as a result?
Mr. Efforts.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is precisely our concern, is that this would open it up to too broad of construing what needs to be done. I guess when we take a look, I testified earlier today about the intensive use, it gets back to that primary use determination that we use for green acres almost, is that intensive use so considerable that we could consider that to be an intensive use.
Representative? Mr. Dayon, a comment?
If I may comment to that, please. I'd like to ask Mr. Efforts then, if two or three horses would constitute an agricultural situation, if we remove those two or three horses and substituted two or three cows, then what kind of a situation do we have?
Mr. Efforts.
Mr. Chair, members, those are always the age-old questions of what, you know, what constitutes a farm. And, you know, until we come up with some really good definition, I would say that no, we would not grant agricultural classification to farm. Is it reasonable to say that someone could sustain or have intensive use based on two cows or two horses?
Mr. Dayon, quickly.
Chairman Anderson, one other question would be, if those two or three cattle were substituted with two or three llamas, then what would the situation be?
Mr. Efforts.
Mr. Chair, members, I would still have to say that wouldn't be an intensive use of that property.
Okay, Representative Falk has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for walking in late. I was at another event, and maybe this has been covered already. But, Mr. Efforts, you just said that if a person were under this bill to qualify for the lower tax rate, correct me here if I'm wrong, but if that is the case, then the tax base for the local unit of government, whoever is collecting the property taxes, is going to decrease by that amount. And assuming that the cost of services stays the same, does that mean that basically the cost that everybody else pays, whether it's agricultural land or non-agricultural land, would actually have to increase to want to offset this decrease in revenue for essentially this classification or this change in the classification.
Mr. Efforts.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's precisely why assessors take this classification to be very seriously, because anyone that's entitled to it gets it fine. That's the way the system works. But there is a tax advantage to getting these classifications, and yes, Representative, there would be a corresponding shift.
Representative Morrow, I believe, has a question. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to make an observation. I know your plan is to lay this bill over, and I know you've got another testifier, so I was going to simply ask Representative Anderson to work with the entire committee, because I think we have to address the green acres or potential green acres or at least the tax assessment issues, and we think we need to discuss what happens to Representative Lemure's bill if we do this. So I guess my reminder is we're going to lay this over. I think there is more work and more testimony that needs to occur.
Good advice. We have one more testifier. He would come up quickly, please, and he has 1 minute. Please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Howard Goldman. I'm representing the Humane Society of the United States. Thank you for the opportunity to offer some very brief remarks. We have many members in the state that own horses, including me. I've read the language of this bill, and we have one principal concern. It doesn't relate to the tax assessment implications. It's simply, we believe that this bill might undermine the current statutes protecting horses. Those are chapters 343, 346. And the language, intensive agricultural use, we believe might create some ambiguity regarding the applicability of the animal protection statutes. And it simply is a matter, we think, of unintended consequences. I met yesterday with Mr. Sullivan from House Research, who, of course, is here today. And I asked him if the bill would specifically undermine horse protections. And he indicated to me that that was not at all clear whether it would or whether it would not. That being the case, I'd like to urge the committee to add specific language to House File 539 that indicates horse protections will not be affected in any way by this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for the witness? If not, the Representative Anderson, any final words on your bill, House File 539?
Mr. Chairman, we'll work with the committee and others to address the concerns that are before us.
Thank you, Representative. House File 539 then is held over for further consultation here in our committee. Next bill up is House File 101. Is Representative Is he within shouting distance? Okay. We have a break. Should we do mine? Representative Torkelson, would you handle the gavel, please?
Members, we are now going to consider Bill 626. Representative Anderson is approaching the stand, and I'm sure he would like to move his own bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is that the correct motion, Representative Anderson?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
Would you like to make that motion?
Yes, I certainly would.
Representative moves his bill be included, be heard today for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Go ahead, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This bill is rather simple. And I first got the idea for it when we were talking about the ethanol producer payments. And the payment for this year was close to $50 million, and I noticed there was about $150,000 left over from that payment. And I had the idea of putting that money towards something else that would help ethanol and help the use of utilization of ethanol. And I think blender pumps, to me, are the way to go in terms of getting more use of ethanol into our marketplace. So what this bill simply does is take $150,000 for fiscal year 11 and again, or 12 and 13, I should say, to facilitate grants to help service stations install blender pumps at their facilities. Now, it's not a cheap operation to install another pump at a gas station, for example. So this would go a ways. We're looking at $15,000 grants to help stations install a blender pump. And a blender pump, what it does is you have the E10 on one side of your pump, and on the other side of the pump, the right side, you'd have the choice of putting in, I believe, E20, E30, E50, or E85, which is used at a lot of stations in our state. And I do have some numbers on what's available in Minnesota in terms of E85 and such, if I can find the right page here. In Minnesota, there are 355 public and private stations and retailers that handle E85, and of those, 70 of these public stations have at least one blender pump on them. And in total here in the state, there are 123 blender pumps in the state. There's one of those pumps in my district, and I stop there every chance I get to put a blend in my flexible fuel vehicle. A lot of people have talked about a sweet spot of in that E20 to E30 range is giving you the best mileage in an ethanol blended fuel. Some folks say that E85 works very well, but E20 or E30 is kind of that sweet spot and gives you an even better mileage than either E10 or E85. But it's a way I think we need to go to promote ethanol. Our producer payments are ending after this year if we elect to go that way, and we need to continue to promote ethanol in our state. It's been a great product for us and help the economy of farmers and in our rural areas. So this would be a way to incite and to encourage stations to install blender pumps at their location. And I would stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about the location of where the current stations are, their blender pumps, just because as you've got it written here, there's no actual location that you'd be targeting, and I just wondered if, you know, if it's not uniform or distributed evenly or fairly evenly throughout the state, there might be, you know, a lot of lots in southwestern Minnesota, but there'd be none in the metropolitan area or southeastern Minnesota or whatever, and if you're trying to kind of allow for more people using that kind of fuel, that you'd want it distributed more evenly.
Representative Anderson.
That's a very good point, Representative. And right now, most of our... I had a map which showed where the E85 pumps and blender pumps are in the state, and they are more heavily concentrated in southwestern Minnesota. And any way that we could encourage more of those facilities in the metro area here, I would be all ears to hear that. And I would agree that we need to get more of those in the areas where most of the people live. So I would be willing to work with you to try to come up with a plan to get those more evenly spread out across the state. Very good idea.
Representative Anderson B.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, do you have a waiting list of people that are looking for this to be made available to them? And maybe you've got it in a pack and I didn't see it.
Representative Anderson.
I thought I had all of my material with me. Currently, there's been a plan with the Minnesota Clean Air people to incentivize E85 stations. And the wording that I got was that the grant money in there has all been spoken for. And this time of the year is when the application would start to ramp up for spring construction and things like that. So the grant money left available has all been spoken for. So there is a need for this type of grant program.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Any other questions or Representative Falk?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe one logistical question first. Is there a House research bill brief on this? I wasn't given one in my packet. So,
Colby, Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Chair and Representative Falk, no, there is not. And Representative Falk, no, there is not. I didn't prepare research briefs for the two appropriations bills, but be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Representative Falk, do you have a question for Mr. Sullivan?
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. That cleared it up. If actually I have a question for Representative Anderson, if you would allow.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, one question I have, and I agree with the program, is that it seems that these appropriations, there's no requirement that once the owner-operator has received the money that they actually sell ethanol, or they sell blended fuel. So is there the ability to maybe put some language in there that if they actually, because I know pumps can be somewhat expensive, and if there's the opportunity for them to, a station or operator to get a blender pump, even if they don't use it for its intended purpose, that might be an incentive to do so. But I would just like to maybe work with you or work with the committee to get some language required that they actually do sell ethanol with these pumps.
Representative Anderson.
Again, that's a good point. I have some cost figures. Blender pumps are more complicated. Obviously, they offer you five or six different choices, so I would assume that if you put one in, you would indeed offer the blended varieties of gasoline or whatever. It says in total, according to my statistics here, the average cost is approximately $37,000 for a station to install all of the components necessary for one blender and one dispenser. And each additional dispenser would cost about $20,000. So if that's a concern, yes, I would be willing to work to make sure that if they indeed install a pump and tank of that cost, that they would, in fact, dispense what we want them to dispense, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ward, did you have a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Falk addressed one of my questions, but another simple question is, Representative Anderson is, and I think this is a good program, but is this just for new pumps, putting in new pumps, or can somebody that has already installed a pump come back, and is this going to be retroactive?
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. This would be for new pumps going forward, and any pumps that are already installed are hitting the ground running, so this would be for new installations going forward from whenever this would be enacted.
Just to follow up then, Mr. Chair, is that I don't see that in the actual language. Is there something in the actual language that designates it as just for new installations?
Representative Anderson?
There probably isn't that exact language, but I would assume I would assume that this would be for going forward, and to help me here is Mr. Krogman from the Petroleum Marketers Association.
Mr. Krogman, please introduce yourself for the record and enlighten us.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our members own and operate about 2,000 of the state's 3,500 convenience stores. They've been involved in blender pump installation. As to Representative Falk's question about guarantees that they use ethanol, typically this has been a grant through the loan association, and as part of acceptance of that grant, you sign a contract where you agree to use that location for E85 and what other blends you pick for a period of years. So that assurance is part of the agreement. The other portions of it as to cost, and it's a new pump, it specifies blender pumps, which is a unique pump. Different than what's currently called an MPD, multi-product dispenser. Three different grades, one hose, but it doesn't have the micro blending valves that a blending pump does, so it would have to be a new pump, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Krogman. Other questions or testifiers? If not, do you have any wrap-up remarks to make, Mr. Anderson? Or
thanks,
Representative
Mr.
Anderson.
Chairman. I got some numbers that nationally there are about 9 million flexible fuel vehicles in operation in our nation. And that represents about 4% of the total vehicles in America. And talk to the Ford people, they were the only people that got back to me, so not trying to promote Ford especially, but approximately 20% of all new Ford vehicles were E85 capable. So that's a pretty sizable amount of new vehicles being produced by at least one of our car manufacturers in this country. So I think it's a coming thing as we get more and more of these flex fuel cars available. And it would help our stations provide what we feel to be a good product for them as we fill up our cars with gas. And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. House File 626 will be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Next, we have House File 101. Representative Erdahl, I believe, is approaching the stand. I would move House File 101 be brought forth today and considered for consideration in the omnibus ag bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. Just have a simple little bill here today that would be easy to do. House File 101 would provide appropriations for the Livestock Investment Grant Program. I know how challenging this legislative session is going to be from the budget standpoint, but I'd like to have this bill laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Agriculture Finance Bill so that we can keep our options open for this program. You notice that the bill is an open appropriation, doesn't have any monetary amounts on it. I trust that at some point through the process of this bill, hopefully some money can be found so that we can keep this appropriation going. I've worked on this livestock initiative for many years, going back to when we were focused exclusively on dairy. We all embrace the idea of expanding the program to make it available to other livestock producers in the state. Our livestock industries are a mainstay of our rural economy. Anything that we can do to help them, especially during these challenging economic times, help to stabilize our rural economy. Just a little history on this program. 2008, there were 38 grants. We had $1 million. 2009, 51 grants, $900,000. In the last round, 245 farmers applied for grants that would help offset investments valued at $39 million. Over 800 producers have applied since 2008. I know we have strong support for this initiative from the Minnesota milk producers, the cattlemen, turkey, pork producers. Representatives from these organizations and others are here today who would be willing to testify in support of this measure or respond to any questions that you may have if you would so desire. I would appreciate the committee's support for this measure to keep it alive so that we can try to direct some resources to our livestock producers. Any questions or comments? I'm more than willing to listen.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erdahl, is this related to the cheeseburger bill at all?
Well, Representative.
No, Representative Erdahl, that's.
No, actually, Representative Erdahl. No, let's not go there.
Representative Erdahl,
I'm sorry I asked
answer
that question,
the question, please.
I'm sorry I asked that question.
I was actually a little confused when I sat down. I wasn't sure if it was the personal responsibility and food consumption bill or the livestock bill. I was prepared to do both.
Well, you did a fine job, Representative Erdahl.
Representative Ward, continue on.
Thank you. How much are you asking for? What I don't see any appropriation in here. Can you tell us what you're asking for?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Ward, it's been $1 million in the past. I mean, frankly, that's not been enough money. I'm not asking for any particular amount in this bill simply because I know of the financial difficulties that we have. And I'm putting it in the trustworthy hands of the members of this committee to, in the process of putting together this expenditure bill, to come up with a fair amount that would at least maintain this program.
So, Representative Ward.
Thank you. So then it's just a general fund appropriations in, Representative Erdahl?
Yes. Representative Erdahl.
And you want us to decide how much?
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're leaving it up to the committee then to decide that?
Representative.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward, yes, and please don't ask for any legacy funding.
Representative, are you done, Representative Ward?
More than done, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl, would you say it's fair to say that the demand for this program far outstrips the supply? I mean, this program has been in a great deal of demand, correct, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The demand is certainly outstripped the availability of the funding. Once again, 800 have applied for it since 2008, 245 last year for 50 grants granted. So there is a great demand. It's mm-hmm. a very popular program. But we have to do things to stimulate our rural economy. In dairy, we're still losing. Dairy farms, the rate had been one a day, and it probably is still close to that. If we're going to keep these very valuable industries of family farms going, we need to do some incentivizing, and this does provide some.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward got one of my questions there, and it was about what kind of money you were thinking about. And another one, though, is I've been made aware that there's been the money that's available through this livestock program sometimes it doesn't get down to the little guys. Is there are there safety mechanisms so that it's available for small farmer types?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Purcell. There are a wide variety of farms. I have a list here of the types of operations, and the Department of Agriculture determines the who gets the grants, and there is a variety. I mean, here, someone in Dodge County, a beginning swine farmer, built a new nursery facility. So I would imagine that that's not really, a high level in terms of cost. They don't have the how much for each of these, but a remodeled freestall dairy barn for cow comfort. Here's one, environmental upgrades to a turkey barn. So all kinds of different varieties, and I'm sure that there are some that are what you would categorize as the big farmers, but also some medium and smaller ones as well.
Representative Purcell, a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to bring that concern forward that I have, that then maybe it's something that we do as we go ahead with how working with Department of Ag and looking into that, how these funds have been granted, and make sure that we've got some small farmers involved in that process so that it's not just a large, the big farms keep getting bigger, I mean, that's actually, when I was a kid, we used to farm 160, 320, and you don't see that anymore, so.
I did too, Representative. We have the Department of Ag here. Maybe they could talk to us about how these grants are selected. Ms. Grothier, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Greta Gothier from the Department of Agriculture. And yes, I do have some information on how those grants were determined and what the demand has been in the 2 years of the program. In the first year of the program, 08, we had eligible grants totaling $11.2 million, and we had just under $1 million to grant out, so we granted that out to 38 different farmers. And then in 09, we had eligible grants of $3.1 million, which we granted out to 51 farmers, and for a total of about $900,000, Mr. Chairman. So we have had far more demand than the $1 million or so that we have had to make grants from this program. So I think it's fair to say the demand is out there, Mr. Chairman. In terms of criteria and who has been getting and how we've distributed the money, the priority has been given to beginning farmers. That is defined as people who have been farming less than 5 years. Also, to those projects that are also a new operation under 2 years old, that are using new technology or trying to upgrade or improve their facility, that can increase livestock production in Minnesota on their operation. And also we've given priority to if they have an ongoing plan for their business and how they intend to proceed in the future and that sort of thing. So we have given priority to small beginning farmers. However, we have also tried to balance it in the previous administration, tried to balance between the larger operations that are seeking to improve their facility and expand their production and the smaller ones that are starting. So that's kind of a history for you, if you will, and we'd love to have input on what the criteria should be for the future. So thank you, Representative Purcell, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Ms. Grothier. Mm-hmm. Next question from Representative Falk.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to make a comment that maybe Representative Ertl preempted me, but I was going to say that your committee is the only committee with any money.
I think he's speechless. Representative Ertl.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Falk, there may be a little bit of truth to that, but there's money everywhere if you really look for it.
Representative Falk, a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm good.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Gauthier, this would, question would be for you, I guess. And dealing with the demand, again, outstripping the supply here of funds that are available, how is it that it's determined then to cut off? You know, is it cutting off people who are applying that would otherwise qualify, or are you lowering the amount of the grant that's given to each person that's applying? I guess my question is, are there people out there who qualify, who would qualify if there were enough funds, that are not getting anything, or is everyone just getting less?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Eakin, my understanding is that we have a ranking system based on the criteria I gave you, and each project is ranked a number of points from 0 to 5, depending on how well they meet those criteria. For example, if it's a brand new operation with a beginning farmer, then they would automatically receive 5 points in each of those categories. So they would, and my understanding is that we have started with the highest points and gone down the list. I don't know how far down we have gotten, but I can get that information to you. But I would also note that in the rounds of making the decisions on assigning the ranking points, there was a team of people that did that, including stakeholders such as the Farmers Union, et cetera, and other groups. So it's not just the Department of Agriculture that was doing it, but several people that did theirs in on their own, and then compiling those and taking a look at them as well. So we've tried to work with the community at large to rank these projects. But I can certainly get you more detail, Representative Eakin.
Okay, thank you. And
Mr. More. Representative Eakin.
And Mr. Chair, and I guess this would go to Representative Ertl, as far as the grants, I think it's a wonderful program and something we do need to keep going, but I was just discussing with a friend this morning about tax credits possibly, and tax credits, one advantage that you probably have with the livestock tax credit would be that you wouldn't run out of the money necessarily, because tax credits apply to everyone and it would be there for everybody that qualifies, regardless of what the amount is. And just wanted your thoughts, I guess, on the livestock tax credit possibility, if that's something that you're looking at.
Representative Ertl.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eakin, actually, it is something that has been discussed this session again. Some talk about going back to the original, which was the dairy investment tax credit, or expand it, as you were perhaps suggesting, to a livestock investment tax credit. I will say, yes, it is being discussed. Okay. Don't know if we can do it. I mean, it does affect the general fund, these darn fiscal notes that they do on those things. But it is being talked about.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions from members of the committee? Ms. Gauthier?
No.
Okay. Thank you for adding some insight to us. Any final thoughts, Representative Ertl?
Thank you very much. Always appreciate the opportunity to come back to a committee that I served in for a long time. And I've been called away to vote. So thank you very much. I appreciate your help. And I'm sure that I'll be around again for another important bill in not too long.
Thanks, Representative. With that, this bill, House File Number 101, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Agriculture Bill. No further questions. This meeting stands adjourned.